This is On the Other Hand. Podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders and local experts.
Hello, and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, Glenn White, here with my co-host, April Chatham Carpenter. Get ready for today's conversation with a community leader and subject matter expert in Arkansas who is helping work towards solutions.
We had a great conversation with Dr. Neetan Agarwal from University of Arkansas at Little Rock in our previous episode, and now we're going to continue with the second part of the conversation we had with him. And in this next episode, we're going to hear more about his research and ideas on how to improve our social media diet. Yeah, I did want to ask a question, and this is a question that I think our listeners might have. We have listeners from all sides of the political spectrum, and I think that there has been an assumption that misinformation and disinformation has come only from one side, and I would love to hear you I don't know if you find this to be true, maybe outside the U.S., if it'd be easier to talk about it than things in the U.S., but usually misinformation and disinformation is from extremes on both sides. But in the COVID examples, I think the more conservative side of the house tended to be seen as the ones who were perpetuating that. I'm not going to ask you to get into your politics on this, but I am curious as to how does someone who might come, like I do, from a more conservative point of view, how do I deal with this disinformation, misinformation concern that it may be levied towards it's your side's problem?
That's a great question. And I think this is also a question about perspectives and knowing the full picture. I can give you several examples, and prominently during COVID-19 or also during elections that we have studied in various parts of the world, in Europe and also in the Indo-Pacific region, where we have seen that such efforts were deliberately pushed on social media platforms to affect both sides of the political spectrum. Because the main reason behind such efforts were to sow discord, create chaos in the society, provoke hysteria in the society. So that way the discourse that is happening on social media, which is civil discourse happening on social media, goes nowhere. People feel disenfranchised and they start just, leaving those discourse spaces or get into their echo chambers or filter bubbles, their own closed communities, which creates this tribalism effect in social media platforms. So we have seen numerous cases of those. And we have actually gone as far as to study this phenomena from our information science and computer science theories, looking at the spread of such behaviors. We have seen how toxic discourse that is injected by bots that I had explained earlier. Bots were injecting toxicity in these discourse to nuke a discussion, to make sure that the community fractures. And we did many studies during COVID crisis where we saw such bots injecting discourse, injecting toxicity about vaccines, toxicity about masks, toxicity about just simple things like stay at home or lockdown measures to rile up different camps with different ideologies and not let them speak with each other. Such efforts or such behaviors were quite contagious. And when we look at theories from epidemiology, we were able to model these behaviors quite accurately, right? How toxicity spreads in a network of individuals, right? So we were able to do that. We were able to study and model that spread using mathematical equations, predicted how likely an individual will be after seeing a toxic post. So how likely are you to going to post a toxic comment after seeing a toxic comment, right? And the turns out they're very close to 80%, which is quite high, right? So 80% of the times, if you see a toxic comment, you are more likely to post a toxic comment. And that tells us quite a great deal about what social media platforms can do to stem this toxicity on their platforms, right? So if you are able to proactively or in time identify such toxic posts or such toxic comments, maybe remove them or delay the posting of such comments, then that could help in making our societies more resilient and also our discourse more healthy, healing our societies, bridging these gaps or fractures in the communities.
You said so many things there in terms of both sides sowing discord, promoting hysteria, moving us into our echo chambers and leaving the discourse spaces. I love that term. I mean, I hate the fact that this happens, but the fact that this is actually increasing the likelihood that we are not going to be talking to each other. And, you know, I think until I've talked to you, I'll be honest, I think until we've been having this discussion, I kind of blamed it on the media, the media like on the left and the right that aren't necessarily always seeing it from a more centrist perspective. But it sounds like that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes in what we're taking in than just the traditional media. What recommendations do you have for reducing those negative impacts of social media so that we can get back to the more respectful ways of interacting?
Sure. And I think one of the ways, as a scientist, I would suggest that there is more need for interdisciplinary work, more need for understanding behaviors, both computationally as well as social science, behavioral science, cognitive science, communication, marketing, advertising, because ultimately these are influence campaigns, persuasion, right? So we need as many disciplines as we can involve in this effort. This is really a very complex problem. As you also mentioned, from the surface, it doesn't seem very sophisticated, very complex, but when you start peeling the layers, the more you peel, the more you cry, right? So that's how it kind of is. So certainly we need more interdisciplinary research in this. I also would go as far as saying that we need generational funding for this work, which means that we don't necessarily just want to increase funding for this problem now, but it has to be in stages, meaning what the funding should be for research as well as, you know, training our generations of learners. When we look at education awareness efforts in European countries that share border with Russia, for instance, when you look at countries like Finland, where the media literacy education programs are the strongest in the world, they start their media literacy programs from the kindergarten, right? So as early as possible. And those type of efforts have been shown to be very successful by the time when we get to an age where people are, you know, constantly on these platforms, TikTok, Instagram, etc. They're already aware and they know how to critically analyze information. So that is a very important part of this equation. We want to make sure that the research is strong, it is grounded in theories, it is interdisciplinary, but also education efforts need to be strengthened from the very beginning. So that's why I emphasize on a generational funding approach for this type of a work. The third, as I had mentioned before, a synergy between government and social media, policymakers and social media platforms. So these things are definitely needed. And here I also would like to champion and express my gratitude for Senator John Bozeman from Arkansas, who has championed for this type of work in the state. So those efforts have helped in strengthening some of our research at Cosmos Research Center to contribute in the solution space for understanding misinformation campaigns, disinformation, adversarial actors, these various types of TTPs, and we constantly evolve our work from existing platforms to more newer and evolving platforms, which are more multimedia-driven platforms like Instagram Reels or short videos, TikTok videos, etc.
Love that statement about the more you peel back, the more you cry, like the onion.
Yeah.
You had indicated that oftentimes what happens is people on both sides get worked up by false information, and that sometimes the intent isn't necessarily to win one side over the other, but simply to spread discord. When I hear that, it sounds like that's the kind of thing that would primarily originate from outside the country by people who are trying to degrade our institutions. Is that accurate, or is it also true that people in this country domestically who are trying to, do things for their side can see some benefit in spreading discord online?
I think that's a very interesting question, and we would certainly need data to understand more about such behaviors. So one of the challenges, because this is a very interesting question we always want to study, and this actually brings us to the key challenge that we have as scientists sitting outside the social media platforms world. And the challenge prominently is to get as much data as possible. So when we work on, let's say, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, all these different platforms, we use their application programming interfaces to capture data and study the data to understand what has been going on, right? But more recently, we have seen an increase in diminishing the data availability, which goes back to the transparency that we need as scientists or as researchers from these social media platforms. And that limited exposure to data that these social media platforms have affects the type of research and the type of research questions that we want to study, precisely some of the things that you also mentioned, Glenn. So that has been one of the key challenges, and becoming more and more complex as we get into these complex behaviors, complex questions, newer platforms. So we have platforms like Rumble, BitChute, Parler, Gab, that are so-called free speech platform. So getting data from such platforms is also very will be also very helpful. And the more such platforms exist, the more chances and opportunities for us to get data. But at the same time, these social media companies have to be more forthcoming to either share their data or have some form of license agreements with researchers from the universities or researchers who are doing this not for profit, right? So that is one of the key challenges that we have here to address problems that you just mentioned.
Okay, so you've talked about the synergy between the media platforms, the media companies, and government. And you've kind of talked about media literacy briefly. Let's start with just at the individual level. Do you have any concrete suggestions for how individual consumers of online platforms, what can they do to improve their own social media behavior and their consumption in a way that is more healthy and reduces the dangers that you've talked about?
I think we can look into several existing successful models that can show us the way forward. So I can give you some examples. On social media platforms, more recently, there have been several statistics about this. On YouTube platforms, 1,000 hours of video, raw video footage is uploaded every minute. That is staggering information that is uploaded there. And almost equal amount of information is being watched on these platforms, right? And slowly there has been a migration from long form videos to short form videos. So if you have seen those TikTok videos or Instagram reels, people are spending more time watching those 5 second, 7 second videos a lot. So those type of behavioral evolutions tell us a few things. Where we may want to introduce things like nudging, where let's say if you spend a lot of time on social media platforms, we want to, send nudges to take a break, or show labels or tags on the information which is not validated or which may be suspicious. So these type of behavioral nudges are shown to be effective, as opposed to telling someone that what you're believing is wrong, because we have seen that those type of efforts from psychological and cognitive sciences, those type of efforts are does not help, and those efforts actually make such individuals more entrenched in their belief systems, right? So we have to be very careful in how we want to present whether information is false or accurate, right? So gentle nudges have proven to be more successful. In terms of the education programs, we, as I said earlier, we should start these programs as early as possible. We cannot expect a crash course week long or a 2 day seminar will solve all the problems, right? So such type of efforts have to be long term or more sustained for a longer or prolonged duration, right? So that has to be there. And then the other part, which was the synergy between government and the social media companies, we want to make sure that this does not equate to infringement on the free speech or the liberties. We want to make sure that this is considered as safeguarding our interests. So kind of ensuring that there are guardrails both sides for the social media platforms, for AI, so that we are not veering off into the unknown or these malicious territories. So such type of guardrails are important. That's why I think it's not just government's role or responsibility to enact laws, introduce bills to make sure that social media companies are following those guidelines. It has to be an effort from both sides. We have seen numerous cases. In Singapore, there is a law called Prevention of Online Falsehoods and Misinformation Act, which is abbreviated as POFMA. That act actually has very strict requirements. So basically, if you have someone who posts a misinformation or information which is deemed as misinformation, could be heavily penalized or can actually go and go to jail or behind bars. So those type of acts are quite stringent, because there is no, almost in most of these gray area cases, it's very difficult to identify whether this is misinformation or not. Or and this these type of acts or laws can also be abused. So these laws or guidelines, whatever we want to, policy guidelines we want to come up for social media platforms, have to be done in a synergistic manner. I would like to give an example. So when automobiles were introduced, right, we did not have airbags or passenger airbags, but slowly those were introduced for the safety of the owners or the passengers of the vehicle. Initially, these things were largely opposed, but slowly we got used to them, and we don't find any cars, right? So that is by law that these things, airbags have to do. So it's very similar to that. I think we need some safety mechanisms in these social media platforms, for all age groups, not just for the protection for young kids, but also for all age groups, because any age group could be vulnerable depending on what type of influence they're exposed to.
I'm glad that you mentioned the need to balance free speech with the synergistic collaboration between government and media platforms, because it does sound like that is needed. But I know there's a lot of complaints, and I think primarily from the right. And April, you may clarify that if you see differently, but it seems like the right is very concerned that anytime the government gets involved in trying to work with or influence the media platforms, that that becomes a way of stifling conservative viewpoints or infringing on freedom. So that's a really critical kind of thing we have to work out. And I'm sure the decisions to be made and the rationale is not going to be an easy one.
Yeah, I mean, I just got back from the Braver Angels National Convention, and there were quite a few people that were talking about the role of media in kind of our perceptions in the space and even looking at propaganda. And I think, you know, to me, the key thing here is that it's not used by one side to demonize the other side, that we are actually looking at it across all of the political spectrum, and looking at the potential for disinformation, misinformation, bad actors, across all of, you know, how we're being all affected by it. If I see, for example, that my political candidate is the only one that's being limited in their speech, and nobody else gets limited, then it automatically makes me assume that this is politically motivated, not that it's motivated out of a desire to safeguard things. And so I think that that's one of the things that has come up. And then, of course, the whole issue of freedom. I mean, we talk about, Glenn, you know, values, right? And sometimes what we consider to be a value, and my own individual choices, and the ability to choose what I do, what I listen to, and not have government tell me that what I can and cannot take in, is also an important, you know, value that oftentimes we have as conservatives. And so I do think that there is that concern that it will be used against us, but whoever the us is. And I would argue that the us can be anybody, anytime we are in our own tribes. And you mentioned tribalism. You know, as I get into my own group and I can only see my own group's perspective, then it becomes more difficult for me to think that anything that the other is saying or doing could absolutely possibly have some merit. So I would like for you to talk briefly about me as an individual person and what I can do to try to get out of those echo chambers. You mentioned the word echo chambers earlier. You know, what can I be doing? This kind of, I guess in some ways, it's a cognitive bias that I have to try to stay in my own comfort level. And I think we have it as human beings. So what do you recommend?
And this is also a very interesting question, because when, as individuals, we see ourselves getting more and more closely knit within our communities, social media platforms and the algorithms there start pushing us deeper and deeper into those filter bubbles, into those echo chambers, primarily because of the algorithms. So it becomes even more challenging and difficult for us to break out of those echo chambers, because I consider these algorithms as kind of a fast food joint, which serves us more and more of fatty foods and sugary drinks, right? And we would, you know, just keep gulping those drinks, or, you know, keep devouring those fatty foods, and we will come back for even more, right? So those algorithms are training us to see more of the same, or I would say worse of the same in some cases, right? So it becomes even more challenging for us to get out, break out of these echo chambers. So we need more concerted effort, either as individuals or groups, to bridge the divides among these different clusters, right? So that has to be partly solved by the education and awareness initiatives that we talked about, right? So having a respectful discourse, listening to others, right? Not just denying their belief system, be receptive to other ideologies, asking more questions. Okay, if you believe in a flat earth, why is that so, right? What about all the other? So basically, having those type of discussions will lead us to having or breaking out of those echo chambers, bridging those communities. As scientists, we can show what is going on in our societies based on the data that we get from these social media platforms. And most of the research in all these platforms show that our societies are becoming more and more tribalistic, more and more divided, as opposed to becoming one or becoming cohesive, right? So that is one of the things that I would like to emphasize. The other, again, the solution I mentioned, the third part, which is the social media platforms and government. So social media platforms also have to become more transparent in their algorithm design or the usage of their algorithms. In fact, there is a great effort called algotransparency.org, which promotes how these social media companies can espouse more transparency in their algorithms, which social media companies are more transparent versus not, etc. So these type of efforts would allow us to also see and evaluate our choices when we make about entering into a discourse or entering into, let's say, an unfamiliar or a viewpoint which is opposite to our belief system.
So, Nitin, I wonder what other information technology issues that we have not yet talked about do we need to be aware of? You mentioned briefly about artificial intelligence. A lot of things are developing in a very fast-paced way in this field. So what are the things that we need to worry about looking forward, and what are the things that are advancements that might give us hope for improvements?
Absolutely. So I consider technology and any type of new technology has both good and bad sides, right? And technology is usually produced for the good, but we also see abuse of that technology, whether it is social media, whether it is AI. So I would take example of AI, right? AI, as we discussed, has been abused by malicious actors to develop these bots or these deepfakes, etc. But AI also has this new large language models like ChatGPT or GPT-3, GPT-4, OpenAI, that is also allowing us to ingest all of this data, millions of data points that I talked about, and quickly summarize them, right? But we have also seen that ChatGPT and all these type of large language models can be used by anyone to create a blog post, create a website, create a video, create a transcript for a speech, something like that. So it has to be an interesting approach or a balance to see how these technologies like AI or social media can be used for the social good, right? So I would consider this both as a challenge as well as opportunity. Some of the newer things that we are seeing in terms of the influence campaign domain are the emergence of newer multimedia-rich environments or the social media platforms like TikTok, Instagram. Most of the research from the scientific community has been focused on the text-based platforms, Twitter, Facebook, etc. But as we are evolving, or our behaviors are migrating from more of these texts to more of the video platforms, I suspect that in the coming years, the influence campaigns or the research studying influence campaigns have to look at such platforms. So that's why some of our newer projects and the grant that I'm writing focuses more on multimedia-rich information space, because we see a multiple modalities of influence, not just the text. We see images, we see audios, we see videos that can be more influential than just a text, right? A 7-second video could be more influential than a full blog post or a full news article, because that's what more people are watching. So we have to understand the effects of newer forms of communication in these platforms. So those are some of the new efforts that are currently going on here. Cosmos.
This has been amazing. And if somebody wanted to go to your website, tell us what that website address is again.
Sure. Anyone who would like to visit Cosmos, the address would be cosmos.ual.edu. Cosmos.ual.edu.
That's spelled COSMOS.
That is correct.
Well, we could have hours of discussions on this, and I can tell already just from listening to you and having you explain these really difficult and complex topics in ways that we could understand them, that you are an amazing teacher as well. So thank you for all the work that you're doing, raising up this next generation, but helping the US and Arkansas actually look at things that are important for us to be considering as individuals and as citizens of this great country.
And I want to thank you as well, Nita. Just wonderful information. And like I said, we had so much that we could have talked about. I hope we find a way to get you back on at some point. I know it may take a while, you're so busy, but let's think about a return engagement at some point, and you can give us kind of an update on where things are with your research, as well as what else we'd like to hear from you. So thanks for sharing your thoughts and things with us. We really appreciate your time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you both, and I really look forward to doing this again so that we can dig deeper into some of the things that we discussed and we left our conversation. So I believe this is first of our conversations. Hopefully we'll have many of these. And thank you again.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the second part of today's discussion with Dr. Nitin Agarwal from University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Be sure to check out the first part of the two-part conversation we had with him, as well as other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. And you can find those on the podcast page of the Braver Angels Arkansas website, and that's at arkansas.braverangels.org. Again, that's arkansas.braverangels.org. You can also find it on many popular podcast sites.
And when you visit our website, you can let us know what you think about our program by responding to a brief survey using the link on our podcast webpage. For program or speaker ideas or other feedback you might have for us, email us at otherhandar@gmail.com. That's otherhandar, no spaces, @gmail.com.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter,
let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.